Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Baumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. Today we hear from former New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman, a Republican leader who has returned to the national stage, this time openly challenging her party. Whitman served in the George W. Bush administration as the head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Now she's calling on the Republican Party to acknowledge the existence of man-made climate change. She's also openly challenged President Donald Trump, calling him unfit to lead the country. In the summer of 2018, she publicly accused the president of putting Russian interests ahead of America's and asked him to resign. Crosscut contributor Enrique Cerna talks with the governor about the decision to take that stance and why she remains a Republican. This conversation is sponsored by Comcast and BECU. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Good morning. I like that. Say good morning, Mr. Cerna. Yes. All right. Good morning, Governor. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Welcome to Seattle.
Good morning to you.
Yes, good morning. We've had our coffee. We're raring to go. So we've got a lot to talk about, not a lot of time, but let's get going here. So is it fun being a Republican these days?
Not a lot. Well, especially if you're the kind of Republican I am, because it's frustrating. This is not the party in which I grew up. It doesn't represent my values right now. But I'm determined to try to get it back to the center, and I think I can only do that by staying within the party rather than becoming an independent. I'm not a Democrat, and I want to change it. I want to get both parties back to the center.
You know, there we go. Give her a round of applause there. I think she deserves that. You know, it's interesting that as of yesterday, a little bit of deja vu in a sense, because it was last July that you wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times. And the headline said, "Calling my fellow Republicans, Trump is clearly unfit to remain in office." This was shortly after Mr. Trump met with Russian leader Vladimir Putin. And you wrote in that op-ed, "President Trump's disgraceful performance in Helsinki, Finland, and in the days since, is an indication that he is not fit to remain in office. I'm a lifelong Republican," you went on to say. "I've campaigned and won as a member of the party. I've served more than one Republican president. My Republican colleagues, once rightfully critical of President Obama's engagement strategy with Vladimir Putin, have to end their willful ignorance of the damage Trump is doing both domestically and internationally. We must put aside the GOP label, as hard as that may be, and demonstrate the leadership our country needs by calling on the president to step down." So what prompted you to write this, and was that difficult to write?
Well, it was a combination of things. I mean, the culminating was that performance in Helsinki where he undermined NATO, he walked away from our allies, and he seemed to engage in an even more overt way with someone who's not going to be our ally, with Vladimir Putin, and giving him the benefit of the doubt on almost anything. And I must say, after I'm still struggling as why more people aren't outraged by the fact that we now know he had a telephone call with Vladimir Putin yesterday, I guess it was, for an hour, and discussed the Mueller report, among other things. That's outrageous.
Yeah.
You know, as a president of the United States, you swear to uphold our Constitution and protect us from all enemies, foreign and domestic, and you don't talk about things like the Russian probe and the Mueller report with the head of the Russian government. And then you don't walk away and say, "Well, I believe him." And especially when you talk about it, he's said several other things to Putin that clearly indicated that he didn't care what his intelligence officers were telling him. And I know that's because he thinks he has more brains and smarter than everybody else, but you do listen to those people who know. And what really worries me is that that kind of behavior is sending a signal to our allies that you better not share information with the United States anymore, because it may go right to the people you don't want to have know it. And that puts us in a more dangerous position than we've ever been in because we need the intelligence of our allies.
And he also admitted that he didn't talk to Mr. Putin at all about the issue of the Russians interfering with our election.
Well, because it didn't happen. I mean, Putin said it didn't happen, so it didn't happen. Sort of like climate change. We don't talk about it, it's not happening.
Yeah. How do you deal with that as a lifelong Republican and someone that has cared so much about the party and the country?
Well, I care about our government. I care about our country. I care about the party because I believe that this country does better with a two-party system. And we need two parties that will engage with one another, being represented people like people. And we were talking about this before, Dan Evans, Scoop Jackson, who two sides of the aisle, but they would, and they were partisan, and they would admit it and wore their labels proudly, but they also understood they were about something bigger than themselves or their party, and they would work on issues that were important to their constituents. And that's what we need more of, and I think we just need to keep standing up and talking about it. I mean, at the end of the day, when people say to me, how did we get here? I said, look in the mirror. Because frankly, if you look at our history of voting, particularly in primaries, it's been abysmal. And until the last couple of cycles, actually the last cycle, the average voter turnout in a primary was 10%. Well, when you're talking about that, you're talking about the most partisan people. And so they're driving the candidates to more extremes every time. And then you end up with people in the general election that the voters look at and say, I don't like either of them, a pox on both your houses, and we haven't been voting in general elections. So we've allowed this thing to spin out of control, and it's now we're paying a heavy price for it, I believe.
How did Donald Trump take over the Republican Party?
He is brilliant at controlling the media. I mean, he's out ahead. He's his own worst enemy in many ways. I mean, the economic news yesterday was very good, and yet he trumped it by having talked to Vladimir Putin for an hour on the phone, and that became the news headline rather than the economic news that he should have been wanting to really talk about, which he's doing today, but that's a little late. He understood that the American people were frustrated, they were angry, they'd seen Congress be totally inactive, unable to address the big issues that we faced. There were a lot of people who were afraid. They didn't feel the economy was working for them. I mean, this is the first generation where we don't look at our children and say, we're going to leave you a better place than we found it. That's always been the American way, is that you always work to ensure that your children or grandchildren would have more opportunities, would have a better world than the one you had. And we're not saying that anymore. We don't have the same kind of feeling about it. And so really it was a reflection on the fact that we've allowed this to happen by not holding our elected representatives in Washington accountable the way we should have been doing.
When you wrote that op-ed last July, what kind of blowback, or did you get much blowback from others in the Republican Party?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you always get people who are strong partisans on either side doing it. But mostly, actually, I was surprised. Most of it was positive. More was positive than negative, let me put it that way, which is why I think there's this deep frustration. It's growing even more, because if you look at party registrations, the parties on both sides are losing. And it's the non-affiliated or independent voters that are people are self-identifying that way now, which my problem with that is that in so many states, you lose your right to vote in primaries, or they make it very difficult to vote in a primary. I mean, in New Jersey, you could be a register independent, but if you want to vote in a primary 2 months before, you have to decide that you're going to be voting Republican or Democrat and have to know that, and you have to go and fill out the forms and declare yourself. Well, a lot of people don't understand that. So by becoming unaffiliated and independent may feel better, may make you feel better to say I'm not one of those, but actually you're not necessarily doing yourself or your country much of a service. And if you watch right now, that's the group that's growing. Neither party is growing at the same rate as the independents. Republicans are losing more than the Democrats, but you're still getting it because the extremes are starting to drive the conversation on both sides now.
Why do you still remain a Republican then?
Because I'm not a Democrat.
That's a good reason.
I'm not a Democrat, and because, as I said before, I want to see the change get back to where it was when I was growing up, when the two sides could work together and could address the issues. Be partisan, that's fine, I get it. And I'm partisan, I'm a Republican. But that doesn't mean I put my party ahead of my country. And that's what we need to get back to, and I don't think you can do that effectively from the outside. You really have to be in, and when I go to colleges, which I've done fairly often, I said to the younger people, look, don't say you're unaffiliated. Find the party that least offends you and try to get it back to the center. Try to get it back to where you would like it to be so we can start having the conversation. Because we're not, and this country is so vast and so diverse that we wouldn't function, I don't believe, very well as a multi-party system throughout the country. Yes, we have independents who are elected and we have Green Party members who are elected here and there, but two-party system is what's run this country, even though our founding fathers were always worried about it, rightly so, as it turns out. That's the way we are and the way we function the best. So I would like to see the two parties get back to the place where they can at least talk to one another.
I take it that you paid close attention to William Barr, the Attorney General, testifying before the Senate and then not testifying before the House. Your impressions of his testimony and how he's handled the things with the Mueller report and all of that?
Well, I was very disappointed watching him do that first press conference after he'd released the letter because he was so apologetic for the president. And, you know, it's fine to say, well, he was under a lot of pressure. Well, he's president. All presidents are under a lot of pressure. Obama was under a lot of pressure. He was being attacked from all sides. I mean, you look through the history, George W. Bush, H.W., it doesn't matter. That's what happens to presidents. It doesn't excuse you then doing things that would be obstruction of justice or getting in the way of the natural process of our democracy. And I felt he was too much of an apologist in that rather than being the impartial attorney general, which is the lawyer for the people of the United States. He's not the president's personal attorney. And I was disappointed because I expected better of him. He has had a very good reputation. He'd been very strong. I think now the only way we're going to get anywhere close to understanding what's really going on is when Bob Mueller testifies. Although I don't know him terribly well, but I do know him, I suspect he is going to be very careful in what he says. He is not partisan. He is not on a witch hunt. But he cares deeply. He cares deeply about the process. He cares deeply about the rules. And he is going to be, he's not going to reveal anything that he shouldn't. And he is not going to, I believe anyway, give any kind of testimony that's going to look like he's has it in for the president or he had it in for somebody else. And so it's going to be not quite as satisfying as some people are going to want it to be. But it will help clarify.
What did that report tell you? Did you feel that it, you know, he said that he couldn't really say that there was collusion, but he obviously said that there were some issues. And did you read it? Did you come away with any?
I've only read parts of it. I haven't read the whole report. I'm still waiting to get my copy, my bound copy. but I think from what I have read, Mueller very clearly outlined why he didn't come to a conclusion on the obstruction, because collusion isn't a term, a legal term for him. And that was his reasoning made sense to me. But to say the way Barr did, that somehow because there were some people that said, no, this is illegal, I am not doing what you tell me to do, that exonerates the president, who there but for some staff people who said, no, I'm not going to carry this out, he would have done it. Clearly, his intent was to interfere. His intent was obstruction. What worries me is that the things that can get him, because I also believe Mueller, whether he, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know whether the Justice Department decision that you can't indict a sitting president is a correct reading of the law or the Constitution or not, but that seems to have been accepted as satisfied and settled, a matter of settled opinion. He could be gotten in New York, and that's what Mueller has sent a lot of those cases to New York, but for many of them, there's a statute of limitations. And if he gets reelected, that runs out. And so that's another thing that's going to make him very, very focused on getting reelected and doing anything that he possibly can to get reelected. So he runs out that statute of limitations.
You know, when we talked earlier today, you said that you were kind of really amazed. I don't know if amazed is the right word, but or maybe frustrated with the fact that you don't feel people are paying enough attention to what the president is or not doing.
And, well, it's worrying. I mean, it's worrying to me that we're willing to say, yeah, he lied again. He lies. Big deal. It is a big deal. He's president of the United States of America. We're better than this. And I have 7 grandchildren. And I hate, fortunately, their parents are very strong and they're setting the right example. But I hate the fact that children are looking at this and thinking this is the president of the United States, and he lies, and people don't seem to care, so maybe it's okay to lie. We worry about bullying in our schools. Well, we have the bully-in-chief in the White House. When someone is willing to denigrate someone else because of a handicap they may have, or demonize them because of the way they wear their hair, or the way they worship, or the country from which they come, that's bullying in the worst sense, and it's coming from the highest, and the president does set a precedent. Like it or not, people look to the president, and particularly young people, and since we don't seem to be teaching civics in school the way we used to, this is their frame of reference. And that's going to do deep, long-term damage if we don't stop it, and if people don't stand up and say, no, this is not okay. Yes, it's what he does, perhaps, but it's not okay.
One thing that I find very worrisome is seeming this growth of white nationalism in the country. We've seen that in Charlottesville. We heard mixed messages from Mr. Trump afterwards, you know. And yet, that still seems to go on. I imagine it upsets you, but you worry about that? Do you worry about it being associated with the Republican Party?
Oh, very much so, because it is associated with the Republican Party now, because some of our leaders in Washington have stood up and defended the president when he said there were good people on both sides. I'm sorry, with the neo-Nazis, there weren't. And it is very concerning. I mean, okay, let's admit it. We all have prejudices. We may want to think we don't, but we all do. We look at somebody, and depending on how they wear their hair or whether their pants are around their knees or whatever, we make certain assumptions. We just do it. The point is to understand that that's what we're doing and that that's not all that person is and to get over it. That's not what this president does. He takes this and takes it to an extreme and says it's okay to judge somebody that way. It's okay to judge them by where they've come from. And we have to get over this racist approach. I mean, just yesterday at 2 different events, California, I think, where they dropped Nazi propaganda on outdoor events from a drone. I mean, we've always had this. We can't pretend we haven't been racist. I mean, we have a very mixed history with African slavery, with what we did to the American Indians. I mean, we haven't always behaved ourselves in the way that the better angels of our nature would have indicated we should have behaved. But we ought to recognize that and for what it is and understand that it's wrong and get over it. And now we seem to be sliding back into it's okay to say and do these things. We've always been that way, but it hasn't been okay to act it out. It hasn't been okay to say it publicly. You'd be embarrassed. You wouldn't want to do that. Now it's okay. And that's very concerning. I tend to go back. I love Broadway, old Broadway shows. I'm old Broadway shows. And from South Pacific, people, there's a song there, you've got to be taught to hate and fear. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear, to hate all the people your relatives hate, people whose eyes are oddly made, people whose skin is a different shade. And that's true. Children are not born prejudiced, but they learn from their parents. They learn from the people around them. And I'm just afraid we're sending a really bad message these days.
The immigration issue, I think it was in the Washington Post recently that they were saying that Mr. Trump feels that that is an issue that he can really carry him to a second term and the way he's handled all of that. Mm-hmm. How's that play for you? I mean, the separations at the border of families, the constant drumbeat that there's a crisis.
at the southern border.
Well, we clearly have an issue. It's fascinating to me that with all the talk of that Trump does and all the things, steps that he's supposedly taken to keep us safe, there are more people coming across than ever were before. So you sort of want to say, well, that isn't working. Maybe you ought to think of something else. I mean, clearly we have a crisis. Clearly there are problems. I thought George W. Bush sent a very good proposal up to the Hill way back when, 2002, I believe he sent it up, as a starting point to talk about how do we deal with this. I mean, we're not going to find 10 to 12 million illegal immigrants who are in this country right now. We're not going to find them all. What do you do if you do find them? Where are you going to put them? Who's going to take them? I mean, we have to find a way to citizenship, a path to citizenship that doesn't put them at the head of the line, but that makes some sense. Then we've got this administration has cut by about 20% our aid to organizations like Catholic Charities in Honduras and Guatemala and in countries in Venezuela. Well, that's a whole different issue right now. And where we try to help organizations that try to help the people on the ground so that they can make their lives better there and not feel they have to come to this country in order to survive. But separating children from their parents, that's not going to make us any safer. All it's doing is traumatizing them, traumatizing the parents, turning them against us in the long run, and making a breeding ground for future extremists who are not going to be our allies. We've got to figure out a better way. I wish I had all the answers. I don't. But it's clear that what this administration is doing now is not working, or we wouldn't be having this, the crisis wouldn't be getting worse all the time.
Yeah. Did you ever think about running against Mr. Trump?
No. No, my party wouldn't have me on a bet.
Would you like to see another Republican, though, take him on?
Oh, yes. I'd love to see a Republican challenge him. I mean, really challenge him. But the problem for any Republican challenging is that he controls the system to get the nomination through the convention. So you wouldn't have a chance doing that. And if you run as an independent, I mean, frankly, me, I'd like to see a bipartisan ticket. I'd love to see Republican, Democrat, Democrat, Republican, because that's what we need as a country. But the problem on running as an independent is let me put it another way, if you run as a Republican against him in the primary and lose, which I think you will absolutely do because he controls the primary process, then you can't run in that cycle against him for president because so many states have the no sore losers clause that you can't get on the ballot in enough states to get 270 electoral votes. So you have to come at it at the outside as an independent. The problem with trying to come at it from the outside as an independent is that the Commission on Presidential Debates has certain criteria. They're supposed to be nonpartisan, bipartisan, well, nonpartisan, really. But their criteria is such that unless you're a multimillionaire, you can't get into any one of the three sanctioned presidential debates. And if you're not on the main stage there, as we saw with the Republican primary the last time around, if you're not in the sanctioned debates, nobody takes you seriously. You can't get the earned media, and you're not going to be successful. So I was part of a group that was trying to change that, and had a lawsuit against the commission. But at the end of the day, we lost, unfortunately.
Let's change gears here and talk about the Environmental Protection Agency, which you were the administrator of for some time. Also, this is, you know very well, this is also the home of William Ruckless House, the very first administrator.
Wonderful man.
Yeah, you know him well, yeah. And he means a lot to this state. He's had great history. I know you're good for him. Your concerns about the EPA, Scott Pruitt headed it for a while. Now it's Anthony Wheeler, I believe, that's heading it now. I have a friend that worked at the EPA, and basically she ended up getting out and retiring because of the direction of the agency and the fact that the whole issue of climate change was one, as she told me, that you couldn't even mention that in any memos, and it was like, you don't go there. Now, you are a believer that climate change really does exist. You've written about it, and I would take it that you're very concerned about where the EPA has gone.
I'm extremely concerned. I'm extremely concerned about the way this administration, or this administration's attitude towards science. and the fact that it dismisses science if it doesn't agree with it absolutely, and that they are so stacking the science advisory panels and the boards that industry has a right to be heard on any regulation that affects them, because they do know more probably about that particular industry and how the regulation will impact it. So they have a right to be heard, but not to dominate, because it's got to be the pure science in the end that determines what's safe and best for the American people and for our environment. That's what the agency is all about. It's about protecting the health and safety of the people and the environment. And this administration is undermining that. It's also sending a message to young people as they look at careers. You'd say, well, why do I want to be a scientist, or why would I want to go to the EPA? Nobody pays any attention to it. It's denigrated all the time. What the administration really wants to do is get rid of it, and so they're starving it for money. And we are losing people with the institutional knowledge, such as your friend. They're fortunately for us, there's still a group there that just will not leave because they think it's too important, they care too much, and they want to ride this out and say, we'll get another president and we'll get another administration that does care about the environment and will let science be heard and let science be the determinant in so much of it. I mean, politics and policymaking is always a part of every decision. Don't get me wrong. I'm not naive that way. I understand that. But it still has to be based on good science, on sound science, and that's not what's happening anymore, and it is being undermined. And while Scott Pruitt was a disaster from an ethics point of view, I rather liked having him there, because every time he made a pronouncement and said he was rolling back a regulation, you knew that wasn't going to stick, because he didn't know what he was doing. And you can't just say, get up one morning and say, no, I think arsenic's good for everybody, and let that be it. And so he was doing it for headlines, but you knew it was going to get rolled back in the courts. It had to be. Unfortunately, Anthony Wheeler knows exactly how to do it. And so with the regulations that are being rolled back now, they're going to be much harder to undo, and the damage to the environment is going to take much longer to rectify if we can. And then when you see what's happening with the Department of Interior and the leases that are being given and the parks that have been set aside and the federal lands that are now going to be exploited, I understand we want to have energy independence. I'm all for it. But, you know, we have solar, we have wind, we have a whole lot of I'm also one of those that probably is outside most people's comfort zone, which I say, you know, we have a transition period until we can get those renewables to be base power and not just peak shaving. And we have the perfect solution in my mind, or we have a good solution in my mind, which is nuclear. Rather than close the nuclear plants we currently have, let's keep them going. Let's do our investment in small modular reactors as a transition until we can make those renewables base power. But they're a long way from being, they're only about 18% at the highest of the overall energy usage. And while natural gas is cleaner than coal, it still releases pollutants. And nuclear, when it's producing power, is not releasing any greenhouse gases or other regulated pollutants. And so for that transition period, I think we ought to not keep closing down nuclear reactors as long as they are meeting our safety standards.
Here's an audience question. Governor, what advice do you have for EPA scientists like me?
Where are you?
Oh, no, we'll put you out. Who are watching the administration dismantle environmental policy and ignore science?
Hang in there. No, I mean, it's serious. We need the good people. We need the scientists who care. At EPA, you know, it's one of those agencies that I knew about before I went there because I'd been a governor and I dealt with them, but I didn't understand exactly how constrained it is by the enabling legislation that tells you, in many instances, precisely what you can and can't do under the Clean Air Act, when you may consider cost-benefit analysis, when you must consider it, and when you absolutely can't consider it. And somehow Congress, way back when, in the 1970s, figured out all this. I don't know how, but they did. But we need those people who have that institutional knowledge. It's complicated, it's hard, and they need to stay there, because otherwise, when we do get a change in administration, and it has to happen, whether it happens in 2020 or not till 2024, that's up to us, but it will happen. And we still need those people who have that knowledge and have that history who can help right this ship again, because you know, the environment is so critically important. Not to talk about climate change isn't going to make it go away. everybody knows it's happening because they see it. It's a national security issue because our military is intimately involved with responding to crises because of climate change. And the Navy, for instance, has done several mock-ups. And what do they do as the Bering Sea opens up? The Russians already have submarines going up there. We think there are a lot of natural resources under the Bering Sea. Canada wants them, claims part of them. Russia claims part of them. We need to be engaged. And as cruise ships go up and things happen, because we've dismantled a lot of our stations along the Alaskan coastline in the north, to respond. We only have two icebreakers in this country. Russia has about seven. Our two, one's light for lighter ice and the other's for heavier ice, and they do the Arctic and the Antarctic. So if they're down in the Antarctic and something happens in the Arctic, it's going to be a while before they get there to you. I mean, you don't just chug up from one end of the earth to the other. We need to understand those things and be more prepared to deal with them, and that's part of what is happening to us through climate change, and we need to talk about it, and how do we harden ourselves? I was talking to you before about this, because
the increase in temperatures here.
It's from a book, but it's called The World as We Know It is Melting Away, and just this one set of statistics. In 2050, the global mean temperature reached 1 centigrade above pre-industrial levels, hotter than our planet has been all of human history. If it gets to 1.5 more, nearly all coral reefs would die out. Areas burned by American wildfires could quadruple. Extremely high temperatures could double globally. 270 million more people would be exposed to water scarcity and 132 million more to extreme drought. And we are almost certain to reach 2 degrees centigrade of warming in the second half of this century, no matter what we do. Well, those statistics are pretty scary, because when you look at the 271 million more people we be exposed to water scarcity, a lot of those are in sub-Sahara Africa, where you're already seeing it. It's forcing nomadic people to move into cities that don't have jobs for them or places for them. And guess what? That's where Al-Qaeda goes and other terrorist groups go to recruit, because people have no hope. This is offering them a way out. And so we have got to be concerned about this. And that's why we need those scientists that understand the issues deeply to help us, guide us. What can we do? How can we slow it? It's a natural phenomenon, but what we're doing as humans is so changing nature that she can't absorb it anymore. And Mother Nature's a little ticked off at this moment.
And yet we have the current EPA administrator, Anthony Weiner, who recently said that he didn't feel that the impact of climate change would be felt for another 50 to 75 years. And I think that that actually goes against some of the documentation that the EPA scientists have established about the effects of climate change already.
No, it's true. It's happening. It's happening at a much faster level than we've ever thought. And if you look at that study that just came out, 2 days ago on the trees and the rings in the trees that they've been able to look at and dig down deeper and see how fast the climate is warming, it's much faster than scientists thought it was going to happen. Now, is it going to happen tomorrow? No. Are we going to be inundated with floods? No, but we are right now. I mean, we're moving about 5 Native Alaskan tribes they've had to move because of sea level rise and intrusion from storms. They can no longer live in their villages. They've had to move. Well, you know, you think about it and say, okay, well, we're having to move this group of people. What do you move? Do you move the school first, the hospital first, the grocery store first, the houses first? How do you get an infrastructure to them? Where do you move them? Their whole way of life has had to change because they can't depend on the ocean and the sea and the way they used to hunt and fish and the way that they have in the past, because that's changing. We just saw, what was it, a week ago, that the second largest emperor penguin colony in the world has disappeared. And they think that's from a large ice floe that melted and that fell into the ocean. These things, we've got to do a better job, and this is where the scientists really can help us, because it's not the way we've talked about it in the past, but to help people understand the link between humans and our natural environment, and that we are part of our natural environment. I mean, some of the things that people don't know, one of the things I learned when I was governor We are on in Cape May, New Jersey. We're on the flight path, on the flyway for piping plovers and the red knot coming up from South America. And they stop there because the horseshoe crab. The beaches in Cape May, at times, you can't walk on them because of horseshoe crabs. And the birds feed on the eggs of the horseshoe crab. Well, the elvers, the people who fish for eels, for bait for our commercial and recreational fishermen, also use those eggs. So there was a tension there. But the real key is the blood of the horseshoe crab is the purest thing still today that drug companies use against which to test their drugs. The purity of their drugs is tested against the blood of the horseshoe crab. So we need to keep, for all these reasons, it's not just about being tree huggers and caring about the birds or being just for the commercial fishermen, it's also for our health and those businesses. So we had to find a way to limit how many of the horseshoe crabs and the eggs that various parts took and how when they, because you can take the blood from the horseshoe crab and not kill the crab, and not all the pharmaceutical companies were doing it the way they should, so we had to regulate that too. But we've got to understand as humans that we really have a very intimate relate. We are part of the natural environment. And maybe if we start talking that way, people will pay a little bit more attention than they will if you talk about climate change, which seems so big and so out there. Yeah. And beyond the scope of any...
Another audience question regarding climate change. And what do you see as a viable path forward in regards to addressing climate change for the remainder of the Trump presidency?
Well, the good news to me is that for the first time in my memory, environment is going to be part of this presidential campaign. And climate change will be a part of this presidential campaign. And the Republicans can't avoid it. The Democrats are going to push it. The public, I mean, every poll, even amongst Republicans, show that better than 50% of the American people say, yes, it's happening. Yes, humans have a role to play, and we should be doing something about it. So it's going to be an issue, and then it's going to be up to us how much of an issue we make it, and whether we say to our candidates, okay, how seriously do you take this? What do you want to do about it? How do we start addressing this? Because we're not going to stop it. It is a natural phenomenon, but we can slow it. And slow it to the point where we can start to try to deal with it and prepare for it, because it's coming. It's happening.
Another question. What do you think of the Green New Deal? Or is it the New Green Deal? I don't know.
You know, the Green New Deal, to me, it's a little bit like when Al Gore put out an Inconvenient Truth. It was really good in that it raised the issue, but his hockey stick graph that didn't have sort of any of the parameters on it and made people feel that the world was coming to an end tomorrow. And when it didn't, they said, well, okay, we'll dismiss that. Sometimes when you overreach, you play into the hands of those who want to ignore the issue entirely. The Green New Deal is a good way to raise the issue. It's a good way to get people focused, but they then put everything but the kitchen sink in it. And that, unfortunately, I think is what's killing it. But in a way, that's not altogether bad, because they're going to have to pull out pieces of it. And the pieces of it that are there are ones that we should be debating and should be talking about. And so that's a good thing. It's a mixed bag. I wouldn't accept it in its entirety the way it is, but I think the fact that it's there and that there are pieces there that we should be talking about is a good thing.
So our governor, Jay Inslee, is running for president. He's trying to get the Democratic nomination, and he's made climate change the big issue. And in fact, just came out with his proposal, which calls for some elimination, I believe, of cars and these types of things. What do you think of that idea of running on one particular issue and what he's doing?
Well, nobody can run on just one issue. And frankly, the American people still, it's the economy, it's jobs, it's education. It's going to be all those things, but at least the environment's going to be a central part of it, and enough people are concerned about it and seeing what's happening to make it an important issue. But you don't ever run just on one issue, I don't believe, and I don't think that's the best way to engage the American people or the best way to win an election. You want to talk about the things that are important, all of them. And people dismiss it, and we tend to like the simple things. And we like the quick fixes and, oh, I'll take care of that. Makes us feel better. But I think it's time for us to have that kind of serious conversation where someone gets up and says, look, I'm not going to solve this tomorrow. but this is how I'm going to go about doing it. This is the kind of research that I'm going to want to do. This is the kind of approach that I'm going to take, the way I'm going to go at it. But we're not going to have a solution overnight.
The talk of impeachment of Mr. Trump, what do you think? Bad idea? Good idea?
I think it's going to be a waste of time. It's going to harden his supporters, even though that's an ever-shrinking group. I think continued oversight, continued questioning is absolutely appropriate. That's what should happen. High crimes and misdemeanors are pretty hard, that's a high bar to meet, let's put it that way. But investigating the administration, holding its feet to the fire, making it answer questions, we're actually heading right now to a very serious constitutional crisis, because you have the administration, and we're not going to adhere to any subpoena. Nobody is above the law. But the public, as we were talking before we came in about the underlying distrust that people are beginning to have with the judicial system, the impartiality of the judicial system. Once we lose faith in our judicial system, we're in serious trouble. And we've seen so many judges being appointed and rushed through the Senate with questionable criteria and background, that people are starting to question this, and it's going to make it very difficult when you start to bring forward charges, whether people see this as purely partisan. And until Republicans are going to be willing to stand up with the Democrats and call some of this behavior into question, I think it's all going to get very muddied with partisanship and going to be looked at as pure partisan, even though we have a constitutional issue here of the independence of the three branches of government and whether the president can tell everybody who's ever served with him in his administration that they don't need to adhere to a subpoena. That's a really scary thought, that they think they're above the law and might get away with it.
Another question from the audience. What can we do? Actually, let me find this other one here. Oh, how do you explain the extraordinary durability of Mr. Trump's support among Republicans despite his dishonesty, duplicity, and well-documented incompetence? Now, this was a question here. I didn't come up with that. So,
well, the thing that you've got to remember is that base, is that solid 35 or 40% or whatever you look at, is an ever-shrinking number, because they keep saying the Republican base. Well, the Republican numbers overall are going down. So that 35% may be 35%, but it's of a much smaller number. Every time they do it, it's a smaller number. I can't tell you how many people I've met who said, I'm no longer a Republican. I mean, I believe you had a senator here not too long ago who switched parties, or was it here in Washington or was it in Oregon?
I can't remember now,
but anyway, it's a long-term Republican state senator who said, I can't be a Republican
anymore.
Actually,
I think that was in Iowa.
Was it Iowa?
Recently, yeah,
okay.
Right.
Yeah, that's right, it was Iowa,
because
that's another reason why it was so startling.
Yeah, because it was in the heart of the Midwest.
Said, I can't do this anymore, and that's happening more and more. So that number 32 or 34% is not the Republican Party or the same Republican Party. There's a whole lot of us out there who would not answer the question the same way, let's put it that way.
Question here from the audience. What is a Republican? Particularly, what is a Republican in terms of policy these days?
Good question. I mean, I don't know anymore. I know what I am. I know why when I was growing up, I at one point said to my father, what's the difference between the two parties, or how do you distinguish? And he said, look, if you think of the party, the analogy he used was an umbrella. And he said, the handle of the umbrella are the core principles that you share as a Republican or Democrat. And for Republicans at that point, it was a strong national respect for the individual by less government interference in your everyday life, keeping taxes low so people had kept more of their own money to spend, strong national defense, engagement abroad, and a strong protection of the environment. And that was it. And then the canopy was everybody under that umbrella, and the ribs were how you interpreted those central core feelings so that you could have differences of opinion on various aspects of it. But you still all came under that canopy. And that made some sense to me. because you were allowed to think differently. You didn't have what we have today, and the Democrats are starting to go the same way, these litmus tests. You know, you either believe in climate change or you don't. Well, no, there are a whole lot of nuances in that. You're pro-choice or you're not. No, there are a whole lot of gradations within those things, and that used to be acceptable. It isn't anymore, and that's where I think we're losing it, because we're so diverse. I mean, I could look out in this audience and we could ask any question and we're not going to get 100% everybody agreeing. It's just not going to happen. And that's what we've got to recognize. Doesn't make the other person evil, doesn't make them bad, doesn't necessarily make them wrong if you talk to them a little bit about why they are where they are. But we're losing those subtleties.
I want to get into at least a couple more questions here before we run out of time. Another question from the audience. Why won't current Republican leaders publicly call out the president as a frequent liar?
They won't do it because right now everything in Washington, and frankly it's both sides, are more concerned about winning their next election, getting another percentage point on their reelect or another vote in their caucus. And this has been going on for too long, that they're no longer looking at issues through the policy prism, but through the partisan political prism. And we're allowing them to get away with this. And we have got to stand up and say, no, damn it, this is about these issues. This is about us. This is about the future and our children's future. And so for Republicans right now, Trump controls the money. Trump controls the apparatus. His people are the people who vote in primaries. They're the 10% that vote. And so if you are running as a Republican in a red district, you have to worry about that. And if you're a Democrat in the blue, you're starting to have to worry about someone coming at you from the left, further to the left. So you move further to the left. A Republican, you move further to the right. But it's for too long now, it's always been about just winning and just having that power. To what end? We've lost the feeling that we want to be in that position in order to make positive change. It's not about having a title. It's not about having power per se if you don't use it to a decent end. Now, my end may be different from your end, and we may agree or disagree, and that's how voters decide, but it should be about something bigger than yourself, and we've lost that to a degree. To me, you saw that very clearly with the Merrick Garland nomination, because just looking at it from purely political point of view, why Mitch McConnell said, we're not even going to hold a hearing, and we're not going to even entertain the courtesy meetings. That was so partisan. You wanted to say, no, no, no. Say you'll have the courtesy meetings, that you'll have a hearing. You slow walk things all the time. If you don't want to get it to a vote because you think he might get through, God forbid we should have a competent judge, then just slow walk it. But don't get out there, and he's feeling so, and this is an indication to me of how acceptable now the hyper-partisanship has become, is he felt so comfortable saying, no, we're just not going to do this because in a year we're going to have a different president. That's just wrong. And yet we accepted it.
Do you think Donald Trump can and will be reelected?
I'm afraid it's entirely possible. If the economy keeps going the way it's going, if it keeps strong, and if those who care so deeply don't get out and vote, and if the Democrats, frankly, if the Democrats make, to my mind, the mistake of nominating somebody way to the left, if they nominate someone to the far left, I think it's over. I think Donald Trump will win. And they're being pushed. I would like to, as I think I said before, I would see Joe Biden and Kamala Harris being a nice ticket, a balance there. I think we need somebody who is going to be more to the center than to the extreme. The American people, from everyone that I've talked to, all the polls I've seen, they're hungry for someone who will solve problems and who will stop the partisanship, yeah, or try to.
Something old, something new. We'll see.
Yep.
Christine Whitman, thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more information on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And for the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.